Cool.
What's going on, man?
No, nice to meet you, brother.
Yeah, nice to meet you too, dude. Thank you so much for doing this. Really excited.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Are you,
guys are getting some cool traction with the grading in, at least industry-wide, with folks I know in the biz that are all like, you know, they tap into this and they think it's a cool, legit thing. So,
Great to hear. Yeah, it can be very hard to know if you're just screaming into the abyss or literally anyone's. So it's always nice to hear.
Yeah.
Well, with no further ado, then, I guess, let's do the thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden, it will all become lovely. The flower that opens in the morning light.
This week, we welcome Jamal Robinson to the podcast, Director of Sales and Marketing at New England Brewing Co. Been in the industry for 16 years, I believe.
Yes, sir.
Congratulations to you on being a good beer hunting signifier this year. As I said to you off mic, getting into this and having a week to kind of really get to know you better and hear some of the other talks you've done and read some of your stuff, this is one I'm really excited to have.
Cool. Thanks, man. Appreciate that. No, happy to be here. This is dope.
So I think to start, we certainly want to end with the New England Brewing Co. scholarship that you've put together. In terms of being able to affect change and actually do things that are having wide effect, the ability to do that is very difficult. And when we have these moments like what happened the last year in beer, there's a lot of talk that we can identify things that are happening, but having the talent and the experience to take that and actually get to a finish line where you're really driving change is astounding. And the reason I said what I said before in listening to you, I hear you talk a lot about things like value and the way you tell your story. You had seemed to have a really good knack for getting things done. So I thought for this, it'd be good to dive into your story, kind of lay some context and finish with a long career in beer, what you've learned, and kind of get to what you're doing now and really kind of dive into the weeds on that, if you are cool with that.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's start with the rare story of getting into beer at the age of 18, before 21. How'd you get started, man?
Yeah, man. I was working at a Jewish deli up in Northern Connecticut, called Ryan's Deli, pretty well-known spot around here. And it was, the server, busser, the owner of the local distributor, the Anheuser-Busch distributor, was a regular at the time. He thought I was a good kid. He always sat in my section and thought I was a good kid and just essentially gave me a shot. I was working on my 18th birthday, and him and his wife was like, "Oh, it's your birthday. Here's my car. You gotta call my son." And I didn't even know what he did. I just, you know, thought he was a pretty wealthy Jewish guy that was a nice guy and always left a big tip. But and his card was like VP Budweiser, and I was like, "Oh shit."
Oh wow.
Yeah, and honestly, I had no real intention of calling. It was my mom that kept hounding me, and she's like, "This is an opportunity. You got to call that guy." Blah blah blah. So I finally call him and go in there. Yeah, right. So I call him. I go in there for an interview, essentially, and I met with his son, the GM, and essentially was like, "Dude, I don't know what you did to my dad, but he basically said I got to hire you, and we don't really. You're not even 21. We don't hire anyone at 21. We're full on interns for the year." He's like, "But you start next Monday." I'm like, "What? What is the job? I don't even know what the job is." But it was cool. So just start off hanging neons, building displays, merchandising, you know, stuff like that for AB. And an opportunity came up at the time, was like very early, you know, not long after the InBev buyout. Craft beer was just starting to kind of take off in this area. We had a couple of local breweries, and AB was essentially like started what they called the hand sell position, where they wanted one person at every wholesaler to go to all these beer trainings, to learn about these different brands that they were about to throw on the wall. But also they put in, you know, what would be like an advanced Cicerone training now, where they met with a bunch of the AB brewmasters and went through like sensory training and aroma and marketing analysis and talking about different demographics and how they wanted to target these different brands. And they knew that most of the people at the AB distributors were old school Bud guys that were, you know, stack them high, let them fly kind of dudes and didn't really care about like innovating or doing any of this new stuff. So I only got that position because no one else in the wholesaler wanted it. It was like it was all old school guys that were like, I felt bad. I don't want to fucking learn this.
We
this
can't stack them high.
Yeah, exactly. Because they were literally like teaching us, like, you know, if you get a 5K display, that's a huge win. And to Bud guys, it's like, what? You know?
Yeah.
So it was an opportunity for me. It was like a great opportunity to do something. I had come home from college to help out family. I spent a year in Tennessee, played soccer out there at the David Lipscomb University, a little college down there. And I come home help out my fam. And so it was an opportunity for like the full-time position to kind of evolve from the merchandising thing. Didn't really care about beer at the time, but it was when I went to these training classes. And I was 19. I just turned 20 when I got in that position.
Doing a lot of sensory at 19.
Yeah, so I still had to go through like all the tests and stuff, but they wouldn't let me sample the beer. They kind of made it obvious. Like, you're not 21. We can't, you know, but you still got to pass this shit if you're going to keep this job. And I think that actually helped me in the long run because it was like for the first time I'm smelling, you know, bare knuckle stout. And I'm like, this does smell like chocolate and cocoa. And like, you know, and putting these elements together that I never even considered before. And before it was just kind of a beer, and it was like beer's a thing, we sell it. But that put it into this context and this perspective, and I fell in love, man. It that right there captured me, and I dove all in. And then part of my job when I got back was training the rest of the sales team on like on these products, how they're made, and beer in general. And it's funny, you get guys that have been selling beer for 30 years and had no idea how it's made. You know, so just walking through like the pretty standard brew process and feeling like, all right, I hadn't got an activist thing. I could talk to people. The sales thing might work out in a cool way. And then I just really fell in love with beer in general. So after a couple of years, it was another year or so in that position that I'm like, I really want to get on the craft side. I went down, you know, started getting on Beer Advocate, started trying all the other local beers, and then really wanted to get on the craft side. I wanted to get away from the AB stuff because it was definitely like a pretty specific culture there. And I was feeling like craft beer was like this more fun, more like communal vibey environment. So we were bringing in part of my gig too was helping to bring on new craft brands because the wholesaler was kind of realizing that craft was beginning to be a thing. Mm-hmm. And we had met the owner of Blue Point Brewing at a conference in Hartford, and him and the sales manager at the time at the distributor hit it off, and we were bringing in that brand, and then they were looking for a local rep, and I'm like, this is my opportunity. Like that beer, Hopsical Illusion, back in those days, that was the beer that put me on to IPAs, that like changed my whole perspective on IPAs. Like Amarillo was like new then, right? So big fruity grapefruit and it was they were the only ones kind of using that in an IPA, and it changed my whole perspective. It wasn't just like this bitter thing. So I was like, all right, I want to be able to focus on one brand and work for these guys and kind of try and do something legit. And Pete is like old school hippie from Long Island, like laid back. The interview was like him and I having a couple beers and talking about beer. And I was like, all right. So I actually had to like tone down a little bit because I'm coming from like buttoned up AB, you know, polo shirts and slacks. And that's
the owner of Blue Point.
Yeah. A former owner of Blue Point out there. Yeah. They sold AB, you know, 6.5-7 years later, as I stayed there. And then that's when I left Blue Point. So I ended up staying with Blue Point. I launched Connecticut, for the brand and then all the New England states. And, after almost 7 years there, we got bought by AB. I didn't want to go back to the AB culture. And at this point I'm too entrenched in craft and loving what this is and built some good relationships. So I ended up joining a local brewery here called Stony Creek Brewing that opened up. They were just starting to open up, and they essentially recruited me to come on board and help them build the brand and launch in Connecticut and New England. So that was, I spent almost 6 years with them doing that. And then we parted ways, and then I joined New England Brewing 2.5 years ago. I came on board as director of sales, and then last year I took on the marketing as well.
Hell yeah.
Damn, I mean, that's such a crazy career already, man. I got to ask, that's such a unique kind of junction point of having already experienced, you know, working at Bud, and then like sort of the sales pitch would be, well, now you're entrenched in craft now, but the whole idea is that like we're craftifying Bud. I think obviously it seems like you probably didn't buy that narrative, but I'm just curious about what was going through your brain at that time.
Yeah, definitely. I would say probably at that time, the scariest, most stressful time of my life, because having been on that side, and you know, you've seen how they've worked with other brands, and their big thing was like, look what we did with Goose Island, because that was the only brand they had bought at the time.
Right.
And they're like, look, it's fine. Everything's fine. You know, we're going to keep it craft. And they, you know, they flew us all out there. And, but it was like, it was kind of telling because they weren't specific about what was happening on the sales side. The package was awesome. You know, what they were offering, the 401k, the increase in salary, and all the things to go with it. But, you know, knowing how it works, like that's a, they've got a big infrastructure unless they're going to be building out this craft thing. And we didn't know at the time that they were going to buy another 10 breweries after that. But, and also like they, when they sat us all down and told us everything, first of all, they flew a bunch of us out there and took us to a deep dish pizza. And, you know, yeah, mostly New Yorkers working at the brewery, and all of a sudden you're throwing deep dish. So we all felt slighted in a lot of way. I'm from New Haven. I take pizza very seriously. You know?
Bad start when you're trying to prove you know the culture.
Exactly. But it was, you know, it was telling because they were talking a lot about, you see, like from the brewer's perspective, that there was a lot of improvements there. They're getting equipment and getting cool access to ingredients and stuff that they couldn't use, but didn't have before. But there was no real clear definition on what was happening in sales. And it was a thing. I had a bunch of people tell me, they're like, well, you know, if anybody could help, you know, make AB more craft, you'd be a good fit for that. But there's, at that point in my career, I think it had gotten them more than just the gig and the perks. There was, you know, what I love about craft beer is that it's just as much a culture as it is an industry, you know, and it's never really been, the brands I've worked for have never been just a job to me. They're my life. They're what I put into that and vice versa. And I didn't feel like I could get behind AB as a whole because it was such a machine and I was working for this part of it that was trying to stay true to this part of it versus building this culture and working with, you know, the owner of a company and now being just, you know, a guy in the mix of it all. And it felt to me like going backwards in terms of where I was trying to go.
Yeah.
Totally. It just didn't feel right. And then when the opportunity at Stony came up, it was this opportunity to build this dope brewery on the water, build something from the ground up in my home market. Me and the brewmaster at the time having, you know, full autonomy and coming up with all the marketing and telling the story and hiring the team and building up this thing. And that was an opportunity and an opportunity to learn and grow that I wasn't going to get with AB. There was definitely things that I would have gotten with AB that they were, you know, don't get me wrong, especially in the beginning, I think they gave me my foundation of structure and professionalism, and bringing that to craft beer. Cause when I got to Blue Point, it was laid back, to say the least. And, and to build a brand, you know, definitely laid back, but you got to have structure and you've got to have a game plan and a go to market and you got to follow through on things and relationships matter. And that means you got to say what you're going to do and then do it or don't promise it. And there's a lot of things of that AB really did give me the foundation for that I could come to craft and be successful with. Because one of the things I learned when I was on craft, there wasn't a lot of people getting trained on how to do this thing, right? It was like, we go out to, you know, you hang out at the top accounts, you have a beer and you build relationships, but then nobody's like asking for the sale. You know, there was a lot of the structure that just didn't come, that I didn't get at Blue Point and didn't come till years later. Like we didn't have an infrastructure till years later. So the AB foundation, I think, was a really good thing for me in the long run.
Talk a little bit more about, not to, you know, continue to go back in history, but like I've seen in the evolution of our brewery, I'm sure from like people outside, I think we had a tendency to hire friends and hire people we knew almost like out of maybe like a subconscious worry that a quote unquote outsider would be like, this place is fucked. Like there's no, like, what are they doing? And I don't know how like true that is or not, but I could kind of see it when like one of our production managers now, kind of one of my right hand people, Paul Upham, came from Trillium before. So he was kind of there for Trillium's like really big meteoric rise and stuff. And he's just a more kind of by the book sort of personality anyway. It's exactly what we needed, but seeing sort of those little clashes, really between me and him, or between him and sort of the sort of just like organizational culture or really lack thereof, to apply that to you with Blue Point, like, cause Paul's been so helpful in that way of kind of instituting a lot of like I mean, it sounds so silly now, but like how much we rely on Google Doc. I'm a paper and pencil guy. Like I really, if I have my preferences, but that's, as we've grown, it just has become impractical. So yeah, talk about sort of how you're trying to strike that balance of like not trying to overstep, but also trying to make, you know, bring organization where Blue Point could use it then. Yeah, right.
Nudge it along.
Yeah. I mean, when I came on board, we had three reps. We had a New York City guy, a Long Island guy, and then me, and I took on Connecticut. And that was the first state outside of New York that we were selling in. So there is that reality when you're a regional rep or a regional manager that you're almost like a lone man on an island. You're outside of the, mm-hmm. the home base. Yeah. So I was only at the brewery once a month or so. A couple of years later, we ended up hiring a national sales manager after we had launched a few more states, and hiring a national sales manager to like really oversee the sales and help build out, you know, ABP game plans and teach us some stuff that we hadn't learned yet. For me, it was the focus on like, all right, I've got this opportunity to build a brand. I'm in a market right now that doesn't have a ton of craft in this way. Hoptical was light years ahead of any IPA that was available. So it was about, being diligent and finding the spots I had to be in, and then building those relationships, getting our beer in there and following up. And it was nonstop. It was 24/7. It was the thing where like there were no weekends. It was just a hardcore work ethic and follow through on getting displays and getting beer on the shelf and then following through and then having it pull. It was awesome to have a brand that when you did all the work for actually pulled through, and then the sales resonated from that. So there was definitely the structure in terms of me coming on board and knowing how to build out my day and how to go attack accounts and how to ask for sales and how to follow up and how to track that. Because we didn't have like VIP or anything at the time. So it was really like getting a report from a distributor and then taking the time to just go through and figure out where my gaps are. So the structure was more like the first time we had ever really approached the brand and approach sales, because on Long Island, it was a beast. We were the local guy. The guy we had in the city at the time was old school Irish guy, came from Bath. He had all relationships with all the Irish bars that built crazy volume. So he had this kind of like a little bit of a corporate structure, but a lot of it was relationship building at the time. So it was this cool evolution at the time for me was having strong relationships coming from a wholesaler. We ended up launching with the wholesaler that I was at. So I had strong relationships with all of the reps at the time and realizing the value in that, because I can't sell all that beer on my own. I need those guys on my team. Mm-hmm. and making sure to work with them, making sure to be a liaison to them, and to know that them going out and getting work done for them while they're doing it, so that it's the first thing that they sell when they're out in the trade as well. So it was like these early levels of like wholesaler management, account management, distribution focus, filling in the gaps on places we need to get on tap, and then having enough relationships around that when someone else kind of vouches for you, it helps with that, you know. Those were like the early days of bringing in that structure, I think, to my own market. I had to kind of treat it like my own business.
Yeah,
and I think you made a good point about just sort of, it's inherently insular to be like the fact that you were at the brewery once a month. It's pretty hard to like have huge sway in changing culture if you're that remote.
Yeah. But it was, you know, it was a cool thing because, all right, I came in with structure and a little more stuffy, but those months going out to the brewery added this, like, it was refreshing. It was like feeling like it was a family base. We're a really small team.
Yeah.
You know, and it brought a level to the whole thing where it's like, yeah, man, we're fucking selling beer. You know, we're not putting anybody on the moon here. You know, we're selling beer. This should be fun. If we can't have fun doing this, then we're probably messing up somewhere.
Yeah.
And that was the thing too. It was added some balance, to, it doesn't have to be all so serious. We can have a lot of fun doing this and still do it well and do it right, you know?
Oh yeah.
And now some of my best friends are from, you know, from those accounts, from those relationships, those wholesalers, so forth.
It is the I know it gets used at nauseam, but that community thing of the craft beer community. I've said it on here a lot. Coming from food, I saw all competition from everybody. And there were breweries all around me that were literally like helping their competition out when something would happen that really kind of grabbed me and pulled me into the industry. But to stay on that topic just a little bit, outside of process and structure, are there any other things that you either from a career standpoint learned from big from being in a big company with a big structure, or even from kind of a personal ethos, the way you operate standpoint, lessons you learned that weren't all bad? Because it's so easy to say like AB InBev bad, Kraft good. And like, I'm sure you kind of felt that when AB InBev comes back to buy Blue Point, it's kind of like this, the bad guys buying the good guys is the common narrative. Can you kind of tap into any other real positive things that shaped you into a career that you've had so much success in?
Yeah, and especially you talk about, you know, building a craft brand in a climate like now when there is so much competition. And yeah, we're all family in terms of craft, but there's only so many people that can drink so many beers. So there's a level of competition that's always built in. Yeah. And there's got to be a level, especially when you're building a brand from the ground up, this mentality of go to market. Like, how do I get all this beer to the market? How many people are really realistically going to drink? How many accounts are there? How much beer can I realistically send to those accounts? So forecasting, analyzing data in a real way that you can put into an actionable process to go get that volume, especially when you're talking about trying to grow. You know, there's organic growth, and then there's strategic growth. And it's hard to build a craft brand now without doing it right and attacking a market without having a really clean, good sense of how to do that, and then being able to teach the people underneath you. Because one of the things I've seen, especially a lot of the people that have gotten into craft, they've come in a couple of ways. One, they either worked at a bar or a restaurant, or they've worked at a package store, and they've gotten into, you know, they started working for a brewery because they knew a guy, they liked the brand, or they were good behind the bar, sold a lot of it that way. Yeah. Or they were at the wholesaler. And, you know, the wholesaler comes with some good things, but it also comes with a lot of bad habits. You know, you've got a lot of guys that also kind of have turned into they have so many brands that they don't really spend time like selling. They spend a lot of time taking orders and doing inventory, and they're distracted by a lot of things that come with a wholesaler with a lot of brand building. So you don't always get all of those little nuanced things that you need. So and the teams that I've built, it's been important for me to have compiled the things that I've learned from AB, from the do's and don'ts of craft in general, and then bringing that to a structure to actually teach my guys like how to really be effective out there, how to manage their time, where to spend their time daily. Yeah. You know, that's another thing in seeing the amount of accounts you need to see in a day, and then kind of being able to know when you're building relationships and when you're wasting time, you know, when you're hanging out having beers, and there's a fine line sometimes, but there's a reality to like, all right, if you had left that account 10 or 15 minutes earlier, you didn't really hurt your relationship, and you got to hit two more accounts that your wholesaler wasn't going to be able to hit for you. And those little things are important.
Hmm. Hell yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just thinking of, you know, it's just, distro is just a whole new thing for us really in general. And it is an entirely different challenge from really any other, certainly a different challenge from fucking selling beer in your tap room. It's a literally night and day. But to bring things a little more into the present, and to get into your current job at New England Brewing. How did that all come about? The brewery has always just had a certain allure to me. I honestly don't think it gets enough credit for canning IPA as early as it did with Gandhi Bot and Sea Hag. My sense is the distribution footprint's pretty small, because, man, it's been like you just either expect to have little pulse drops of breweries, or like, frankly, like working in the industry, like shit shows up in the walk-in every now and then, and you know, which is awesome. But I'm honestly not sure if I've had Sea Hag, but other than that, I'm not sure I've had anything else. And it's literally been almost like a brewery bucket list thing for me. So I'd love to just kind of get the inside take of where everything's at right now.
Yeah, I'll have to. I'll make sure today to throw some beers in the mail for you guys, so you can drink.
Well, the same. It won't be today, because that's.
Yeah. We'll tell you we will. We'll remember sometime in 2 weeks, and it'll show up as a nice surprise when you think that we forgot to do it.
Fair enough. I'll take that. But yeah, we only distribute in Connecticut. You know, there was years ago where the brand was distributed in all of New England, and you'd see it. But when Sea Hag and G-Bot took off, it became this thing where the brand couldn't supply enough liquid to for the drinkers in Connecticut. We were always out of stock. I mean, it didn't seem to make sense to be shipping beer all over the region when we couldn't take care of our own backyard. So Rob and team kind of brought focus back, pulled distribution out of all the other states, and then just started shipping and selling in Connecticut. And then growing really organically over the last, you know, Nevco's a 17-year-old brand now.
Yeah.
And this past year, we just hit 17,700 barrels sold in Connecticut, with the bulk of that being Seahag. And we're just now, literally this week, it's just shipping out the door as we speak, Fuzzy Baby Duck 6-pack cans for the first time because we able to squeeze three more fermenters in here. So by the end of this year, we'll be right around
17,000 barrels? Damn, in just Connecticut. Holy shit.
In just Connecticut, which is pretty awesome. It's one of the things that that made me want to come to this brand. I know the guys, I know Rob, the owner, and the director of business development, Marty, used to be with Sierra, a good friend of mine, and I've known him most of my career. So I trusted the guys here and knew them. Greg Radowick, our director of brewery operations, is a phenomenal brewer, super, super smart dude, takes incredible pride in the quality of our beer. And that's one of the big things, because when you look at a brand like this that doesn't have a big marketing budget or hasn't had a big marketing budget, hasn't done a whole lot of strategy, a lot of this pull is because the liquid is good and because people are loyal, brand loyal to the quality of the beer. And that's hard to get nowadays, too, when you're talking about distribution. Yes. So it became even more like, why focus on trying to distribute outside of the market? Especially I've launched every state in when I was with Stony Creek, I launched 28 distributors throughout the region. And you go to every single state and every single part of those states, and there's different nuances to what local means and what's pulling there. And everybody has their own Seahag, their own like hype, you know, that's pulling there. So then that ability to like expand and grow in that way doesn't mean the same thing now as it did 10 years ago. So being realistic about that. So then we're like, how can we push the envelope here in Connecticut? We don't even offer a 12 pack yet. And our big thing now is trying to build a new brewery. Hopefully that'll happen in the next 8 to 11 months that we'll be in a new space, a couple miles from here on the water in West Haven, that we can actually produce the amount of beer that we want. But the brand's been up against capacity for a number of years. And this year was like, we pulled an old cooler out, squeezing in three more fermenters and pushing the canning line to the limit just to keep growing, keep putting out liquid and keep, you know, staying relevant to do some things. Cause again, 80% of the liquid has been sucked up in Seahag. And over the past 2 years, we've been able to put out a couple of more brands to just show the breadth of what we can do as a brand and what we can do in beers, and then offer a bit more than what we like. The tap room always has a nice variety of stuff, but outside of the tap room, because not everybody can get down here and check the beer. So yeah, it's Connecticut only, man. That's been the thing.
I was talking, I'm up here. I come up to Milo like once a week. And when I can, I'll bring someone from Portland, to lend a hand. So we were talking last night and Jeff asked me like, yeah, do you know how big that brewery is? And I can't remember what I said, but I think the separation of that proximity. Few states makes it seem like completely on another world. So like, I was like, I don't know. I guess like half of what you guys are at. That's a crazy amount of volume for one state. For Seahag also, just to touch on the conversation of having a flagship at that level, like 80%. I mean, I believe that's even higher than White, similar to White anyway, if not, but I think it's a little bit higher. I don't even really know what to ask, but about how you manage, distribution for a beer that makes up that much of the company. I'm just super curious because we're at maybe like 50%, maybe 60% is substance, but 80 is just wild.
Well, since COVID hit, so your standard brand is usually like a 70-30 distribution split between off-premise and on-premise. Mm-hmm. And pre-COVID, we were at 50-50. We had so many draft lines that were turning in such a great volume that we were running out of six packs all the time on the shelf, and we figured it made more sense to try and keep those draft lines because you can always get that shelf space back at a store. You can't always get that draft line back. Mm-hmm. And it was one wanting to keep that. And then COVID hit and all of our bars shut down. And then so it automatically inherently shifted the brand to a 70-30 split because the off-premise took off even more than it was. And we shifted some brands in the can. But not having all that on-premise business gave us a little tank capacity to put out some new beers, which in hindsight actually worked out for the best. So mm-hmm. we launched another beer, a hazier IPA. We don't really call it a hazy IPA, but it's a hazier IPA called Face Hugger. And then we've had Supernaut, which is our number two, and that's a 5.2 all mosaic IPA. And then now Fuzzy has been kind of like our hype brand for a long time. That's for 10 years. It's only been available in the tap room. Uh-huh. But now with these new tanks, we actually have the ability to ship it out in six packs in the kind of volume that won't, you know, get it price gouged or hoarded or make people get all weird about it.
Yeah.
But so now I'd say Seahag, because of those additions to those brands, Seahag is now in that like 68% of the total volume, which is still huge in terms of that flagship. And it's all been about, we do a really good job of managing inventory at our distributors. Greg kind of spearheads that, and it's about making sure the beer is fresh. So when you're grabbing a Seahag, and that's with a nice rate of sale, having a nice organic pull, but when you're pulling Seahag from a store anywhere in the state, it's really not more than 2 weeks old or so.
Wow.
And that's important. So instead of trying to send in, you know, 30 days worth of inventory, which is big brand kind of mentality, this is like our distributors are all picking up once or twice a week and keeping low inventories, keeping beer really, really fresh. And customers, I think that's a big part of the brand growth. Customers expect fresh beer from us. They expect when they pick up a Seahag that it's going to be fresh no matter where they get it. And that instinctively, I think, has built in a lot of brand loyalty because the quality never really wavers. And if there is an issue, you produce that much beer, there's going to be issues here and there, whether it's with a seam or whatever. People hit us up and they're like, hey, just want to let you know it's a bad can. Nobody's coming at us in any kind of sideways. Everybody's like loyal and feeling like, hey, just want to let you guys know it's not usually like this. Here you go. You had a mistake, you know, and that's cool too. And then being honest about what we can do. Everyone's been used to not being able to get the brand because they drink it so much and it's been fresh. And now that we're putting out more and being able to get it, I think it just brings people a little bit more brand loyal. But we always focus on that. And we tell our distributors that's what we want before, you know, we used to send out small amounts of Fuzzy Baby Ducks and we know that's the hype, but we ask, you can't really control it fully, but we ask that, you know, we prioritize accounts that are pouring Seahag. That's our bread and butter. That's what people want. And we love Fuzzy, but, you know, that's not what paid the bills for us all these years. So we want to keep our flagship. So we keep focus on our flagship. And even when we're growing, even when we're adding new brands in, it's Seahag's still number one. And our distributors know that. And our accounts know that. We keep it at the price point that's lower than the rest of our beers as well, or the lowest of the beers that are available, to make sure that our accounts and our wholesalers understand that that's priority as well.
What is that price point, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, we've always been a $9.99 on the shelf. This is the first year that we've actually had to take a price increase in the last like 8-9 years. So now it's a $10.99 on the shelf, which is still like a buck or two cheaper than a lot of the other brands.
Oh yeah, for a six pack of cans.
Yeah,
I mean that's
totally.
I mean, I know it goes into beer. It's about as cheap as you could possibly make that.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But yeah, we make our margin and the retailer makes his margin. So there's no, you know, there's no gouging there. And the customer's like, this is a great bang for the buck.
You know, for
11 bucks out the door, I get this beer that I know is going to be dope every time.
Yeah.
And that's what it is, man.
Hell yeah.
And you said you've been there. Go ahead.
And I think our brand culture has a lot to do with it as well. I think people want to get behind NEPCO because of the kind of people we are, the kind of brand we are, the things that we care about. All that stuff, I think, matters, because when we talk about craft beer also being a culture as much as it is, you know, an industry, there's more that latches people onto a brand than just the quality of liquid. That's got to be the anchor for sure. But I think there's some other things that make people like even more proud to rep us and be a part of us, which is cool.
And that's what I want to transition into. It seems like you've been an incredible fit there, even hearing you talk about it now, the kind of that thing you talked about at the beginning with AB InBev, where you've got a guy who's been selling beer for 30 years, but might not be able to list the raw ingredients. The passion with which you speak about it, the knowledgeability. You said 2.5 years you've been there, 2.5, 3?
Yep, 2.5 years now, yeah.
How did that relationship come together? Is that something that you sought out knowing the brewery? Did they seek you out knowing your experience? How did you end up there in the first place?
A little bit of both. So Stony at the end, you know, you're with a brand for a while, and then ownership of a brand, and a brand has aspirations of what the organic growth can do. And I think there was a reality where being one of the more higher paid people at that brewery got to a point where there was market saturation. People weren't pulling as much as it was. So, you know, the ownership cutting top salaries, essentially, I got caught up in that kind of a scenario. Mm-hmm. And became a free agent. And that's a scary time. But Marty, our director of business development here, is a friend of mine. So he was one of my first calls, not from a job perspective, just as a friend of mine who's been along that journey. When I was a guy that's been in this longer than I have, he's, you know, a 20, 30-year guy coming from a wholesaler side as well, worked for Sierra for 10 years and, you know, and now at NEBCO. Mm-hmm. He's a guy that I kind of turned to when I needed some advice and just different perspective. In the industry even when I was at Stony. And so I just called him as kind of like, so this happened today, you know, it's a friend scenario. And, yeah. And he was like, what the hell? You know? So he, you know, talked to Rob, the owner, and was like, this guy's a free agent and we don't want him to go somewhere else. We gotta think about being able to pull him on board. And the idea was that we're going to be opening a new brewery soon. But then it was about a year earlier than they would have wanted to hire someone like me, to bring on. But, it was that, you know, there was a couple of other opportunities that were cool. But this felt like the right brand fit, and the right culture fit, like trusting and knowing the people, knowing the vibe here, knowing the kind of people that I'd be working with, knowing they also know the business. You know, I didn't want to go into a situation with having to be the only guy with experience, the only guy that gets it, and then having to have all that on your shoulders, and then the responsibility of that when it doesn't go the way other people think because they don't understand what's realistic, you know? Mm-hmm. So there was that, and the quality of the liquid, man, the beer is just good here. Like, you know, there was a level of, when I left, I was like, man, there was so much in terms of, like, you know, people talk about hazy IPAs and New England IPAs and this style. And I'm more of an old school West Coast IPA guy, but when a hazy IPA is done well, I get it. It's fucking delicious and it's awesome. Not everybody's doing that. And then not everybody drinking it is thinking about it in that way. So that was also kind of frustrating too. So I'm like, maybe craft beer isn't for me. Maybe I'll go into weed. Maybe I'll go into wine. Maybe I'll go into booze or whatever. And then, you know, but when the NEBCO opportunity came up, I got really, really excited about it and felt like it was a good brand fit. And then sitting in the tap room drinking beers, I'm like, oh, no, I still love beer. I still love craft beer. This is me. So I just need to be at the right place. This is me. Yeah.
In terms of the culture itself, what has NEBCO done, or what are they doing that has kind of allowed you to thrive in it to affect the change that we're going to get into? You know, not everybody is willing to kind of take that step and get into, let's say, lead. Not everybody is willing to lead that. Once something has traction and people have put something together and it's moving, then it seems like everybody wants to get involved with that. But the ability to lead is different. Just talk about NEBCO's culture. I know charity has been a pretty big aspect of what they have done. Talk about the freedom that kind of allowed that to start bubbling into what it is now.
Yeah. Charity and people and community, those have always been cornerstones of this brand. You know, mm-hmm. Rob and especially Marty are dudes that have always cared about that. That's always been one of the pillars, that we take care of our people. We take care of our community. These are the people that drink our beer. And it was about more or less communicating in a way to help expand what that really means and give different perspective, right? If you don't know what you don't know. And I think there's a little bit of that. So when you talk about everything that's happened in the world during 2020, and, you know, I'm coming to the table with a perspective of, you know, where some people or some brands would look at, you know, posting on Black Friday or doing things specifically for Black culture would be feels political, you know, having candid conversations, trusting these guys enough and trusting myself enough and being open enough to be like, you know, I don't have the luxury of it being political. Like every day before I put on my New England Brewing shirt, I got to wake up and be Black in America first. And it's about, if we talk about community, and that's the thing we talk about and we care about, you know, who do we really mean when we say that? And that kind of communication is actually an article that Good Beer Hunting put out around that time that talks specifically about that. Like breweries, like when they say they're about community, who do they really mean? Mm-hmm. And when I had a conversation with my guys about like Black folks are a part of our community. We're on the New Haven line, which is a Black community, and we do a lot of things for charity, but we don't have anything focused on this culture specifically. And there's a huge disconnect in terms of the diversity that's in the industry. I think if we can challenge ourselves and write within our rights to stay exactly on brand and stay exactly to who we are and do more and do other things. Just we do these other things, we can also do this. And everybody was like, you're absolutely right. Like, you know, what can we do? And then it became, you know, that's where responsibility comes in. Cause I felt like especially, you know, I'm on Facebook and Instagram and you're seeing a lot of people posting things and saying things and people that I consider friends of mine saying some shit that they wouldn't say to me, you know? And then now I feel like I've got this as being honest about the fact that I might be the only Black person that a lot of my friends have or really know on an intimate level. And now I have this responsibility to educate my people or the people that I take responsibility to call my friend, yeah. You know? And then there's a reality to how many people are in my position that, you know, have been in the industry as long as I have and also are with a brand and have a voice and have an ability to execute on something and actually do something. So then it felt like I had to take responsibility. It felt like this call to action, that the timing was right and necessary for that. Cause if not me, then who? And then when I talk about my circle and I talk about the people that know me. So that started with just a YouTube video in terms of just voicing opinions and voicing thoughts and a perspective from someone of color in this industry and in this world to people I know. You know, it wasn't about like going on a rant, but it was about trying to be like honest and putting a perspective to people that I don't think took the time to really think about Black history and think about why people are rioting and think about what Black folks are so mad about. And putting it into a little bit different perspective and not being so angry and ranting, but more from an educational place. And that's kind of the approach I took, you know, with our company is having a conversation and being honest in that conversation and trying to give perspective that they are not necessarily in a position to see from. Because, you know, when you're in a place where you've never had to be the only one in the room that looks like you, you don't really know, you don't instinctively know what that feels like or instinctively relate to that. And there are circumstances where it might be unfair to expect someone to be able to understand that without having a conversation and giving them some ways to view that a little differently. And you obviously need to have someone on the other side willing to listen to you and hear that and take it in and then understand. And that happened in a very cool way here. So that spearheaded. So then it was like, all right, what can we do was the question. Now I'm in a position where not that I have to be now the voice of all Black folks, but if I'm going to speak up and have an educational standpoint, then I got to be willing to do something and I got to be willing to take charge and lead that project. I can't expect, you know, other people to lead, but the important thing is having other people that want to be a part of it and want to help in any way they can. So it started instead of just cutting a check because we're like, you know, should we donate to something? And it was like, I don't want it to be just a cut a check. We've got to do something that this gets ingrained into our culture. This is a part of who we are as a brand and something that we believe in and not just cutting a check to check a box. And not that it was about checking a box, but it can feel like that and it can be that if it's not purposeful and intentional. So that's where we started our equality committee, which is an employee-led team initially focused on diversifying the industry, bringing some awareness to racial injustice and helping Black communities in our area, just like we do with other things.
Yeah.
And that has now evolved into having a female led component focused on women and it keeps evolving as we go. But, that's where it started. And then one of the first things was like, all right, how do we diversify the beer industry? And Sacred Heart University is, a university here that just the year prior started their first brewing and science program, which is an 11-month program. It goes through all the everything from brewing, marketing, ownership, sales, tap room, the whole nine. And the lab is at Two Roads is Area 2 facility. So they actually have a whole bunch of single barrel fermenters there that they actually go through the lab on. And it's part of it's online, part of it's in class. And it was something like, all right, let's maybe we can start a scholarship. And that being a first thing, because being realistic about if we want to bring people into craft beer, most people that are getting into craft beer didn't grow up. This isn't like Germany where it's a vocation you come out of high school doing, right? So they're going to be coming from another industry. And if they're interested, if $15,000 is what the program costs, and that's a real number for something that you don't have any experience in any real way. So the full ride scholarship was going to be really important. So we reached out to Sacred Heart. We started talking about what we could do. They were all about it and thought it was awesome. So we had two perspectives. We can do an annual scholarship where we pay that $15K every year. Mm-hmm. But we wanted something that was going to be really long term. And that became building an endowed scholarship.
Damn.
So raising enough money to where the interest from that, what you raise, spins off and pays for the program in perpetuity, whether our brand exists or not. And that's a quarter of $1 million. $250,000 to $300,000 is how much you got to raise. So we didn't want to wait. We set a goal for $5K to raise $50K a year over the next 5 years to do that. But we didn't want to wait 5 years to like start impacting this industry. It's a cool long-term goal, but we needed to do something now and immediate. So we built out a 5-year annual scholarship to go alongside our endowed scholarship that we're fundraising for. And in knowing that, all right, that's a lot of money to raise, I had to ask the question too of like, all right, $250,000, is that the right place to put it? Is there other things in Black community that would be more effective to put $250,000, you know?
Hell yeah.
And in answering that question, I had to also look at like, you know, again, craft beer is a culture, and not just that, it's an enormous economic impact in this country. So when you talk about taking a piece of that pie and diversifying it and giving people of color an opportunity to have a piece of that $83 billion that flows through craft beer over the years, then yeah, that is the right investment. That's an important investment to make.
And can I,
overall,
does that, when you say something like that, and I might want to slow you down a little bit and go through a couple of these steps.
Yeah, sorry, I ran.
getting to the action and how smart this action has been, I think is really warrants some unpacking and going through some of that, because there's so much emotion and different things involved. But what you just said, fucking awesome thing. Like, even it's so easy for me. I get so excited when I have ideas. And you just talked about this moment of like, even I've got some traction here. I think we've got a good idea, but I'm going to stop and I'm going to kind of check myself. It's like, they're a better way to spend $250,000. And then I think if I'm getting your answer right, you kind of talked about how big the craft beer industry is, how much economic output, and maybe more importantly, positive life change, which I would think would tie directly to the things that you have experienced through craft beer. And kind of wanting to share that with more people that look like you in a world where you don't get to see so many people that look like you. Can you kind of talk about the emotion of that process where you're asking yourself a hard question? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it, you know, it is emotional because systemic racism is a thing that exists in every facet of every industry, intentional or not. Mm-hmm. It's a part of American culture. It's built into the fabric of this place. So it is. It's like, all right, I want to help my culture. I want to help my people. And is this the best way to do that? But it's also being honest with myself in terms of what are the tools that I have to use? What are the talents that I have to use? And then how can I really affect change in a meaningful way that is long-term and makes sense for what I can really offer? You know, I'm not an activist in other ways. I haven't been involved in a lot of other things outside of donations. I've spent the last 16 years focused on building a career in an industry that, with a lot of people that don't look like me. And that comes with a lot of different facets. It comes with the ability to be professional, to let certain things roll off you easier than other people might have to. It comes with having the ability to educate and in a way that doesn't snap at people, but also just embracing something that really is dope, right? This industry really is dope in a lot of ways. And that, to me, it came back to these passionate sides of it, the economic impact, the ability, the fact that this industry isn't just some industry. It's a big industry.
Yeah.
It's one of the ones that moves this country and this world in a lot of ways. Like we joke around about Germany coming out of high school being a vocation, but that's real.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's a real big industry, and to have an impact in something so big is important. And it doesn't happen without that kind of an investment and that kind of time and effort to go into it. And if not me, then who?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's, you know, from my own little world, my own little perspective, it's also a level of, you know, taking responsibility for saying one thing and being willing to do what needs to be done in that way. So yeah.
Awesome.
I hope that answers your question.
Totally. And can I go back even a little bit further? Kind of, we have this really charged time in America. Things have been going one way. The George Floyd thing just kind of puts a, you can't not watch that video. And if you think anything else, you need to take a look at yourself after watching 9 minutes of that, you know? And so,
And
you said you heard some words from Good Beer Hunting that kind of framed what you were feeling in a really good way that kind of maybe unlocked something that allowed you to speak and kind of get honed in on what you wanted to say. You put up a YouTube video that gets some traction, and it sounds like your next step was to look inside NEBCO and put a group together of how can I use the platform, or more the mechanism I have, this brewery, see who's with me, put a bunch of heads together and start a diversity, inclusion, equality group. Was that kind of the direct step coming out of the YouTube video, or did you have this scholarship idea cooking already?
No, the scholarship was the brainchild of that group, right? So it's about, you know, putting people in a room and everybody being like, no, you're right, this is important. When we all get there and we all start thinking about it, and then great ideas come out of a bunch of people caring about something.
100%.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't take credit for that being like my brainchild and my like initial. I think me being the catalyst for making that happen, for sure.
But totally.
That's the whole thing about having allies. It's the whole thing about in community, and that we are not ever just alone. It's all of us trying to do this. And that's what it is. It was half of our employees coming together, getting in the room and being like, what can we do? And then start spitballing ideas. And that was a really, really good one that came up.
That's incredible.
Can I ask two things, I guess? One, what does sort of the total enrollment look like in that program? I guess when you started everything, it had only had a year under its belt, but just for a sense of the size of it. And then beyond that, I just want to hear a little bit more about how you guys did settle on the endowment.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that's just wildly interesting to me.
Yeah. So I think that first year of the program, they had 32, 34 students through the program, and they're kind of capping it around 30 or 40 for each cohort. There's two cohorts a year. I think that's how that first year, and then they're trying to grow it and make it a viable placing program. So you go through the 11 months of the program itself, and then you have a six week internship. I think it's 80 hours at a brewery in Connecticut, either a brewery or cidery in Connecticut, that you follow up with. So you get some like real world hands on. So
Awesome. Our
scholarship we built in, we wanted specifically that, you know, after our scholarship recipient goes through the program, that they come to NEBCO and they learn here, and then provides an opportunity to either become an employee here or at least be at a well-known good quality brewery that does the right thing by the beer and by the process, to that now have that experience to have that under your belt, to be qualified going out in the world, not just from the experience, but now you've got a little bit of NEBCO under your belt and using our brand and how hard we've worked to make this brand viable, to now be able to attach that to someone else to be able to use in a way that they can grow from.
100%.
But also first case for us to be able to like diversify our own brewing team as a whole.
Yeah.
You asked about how we built the endowment.
Yeah.
So, we sat down with Sacred Heart and I had to learn a lot about how a scholarship like that works.
Yeah.
I really didn't know. And it basically comes down to you pledge to raise X amount of money. Now you can do, you can do it a couple of ways. You can raise a bunch of money and, you know, portion of whatever that is spins off. So for say, we're going to donate $15,000, or that's how much we're going to raise. It goes into this bigger account with the school, and that incurs interest, you know, 6 or 7%. And then that interest that rolls off of that is what you can use towards the scholarship. Mm-hmm. So it's staying in this account, keeps building interest every year, and then you keep paying that out every year. But at 15K, you know, that's, you know, probably a couple $100 that gets spinned out to the scholarship. And we wanted it to be impactful. We wanted it to pay for the full program so that someone can really come into this wholeheartedly invested and not have to worry about the other aspects of that. And there could be, you know, you could raise half of that and then pay for half the program, and that would be impactful too. So while we're building it, we're, that is starting to spin off, that interest is incurring on every dollar that we put into that endowed fund, so that maybe before we get to that 5 year, we can pay for part of a program in the meantime. But it was about being able to layer it, so that we could have impact now and that we could have impact long-term. Yeah. That would live beyond the impact now. We wrote the scholarship specifically, the language in the scholarship specifically. So it's an African American Brewer scholarship. So you need to be African American, at least a portion African American, mm-hmm. to qualify for the scholarship. And then we wrote it in that if should something happen to Sacred Heart or to the program, it doesn't exist, that money then gets rolled over to another brewing science program with the same scholarship intention. So
smart.
It was important for us to be specific and intentful about what we mean by that. And as we wrote it out, again, the goal to raise all that money long term. Our first year last year, we raised 56K with all of our efforts, and we took it outside the brewery. So I started a separate committee outside of NEPCO, we called the Scholarship Committee, and it was a collection of people from other breweries, Alyssa Mercado from Rhythm Brewing. We had representatives from Two Roads, from Athletic, from Sacred Heart, and from a couple other local breweries from Great Falls here, that were all like, this is a dope thing. I want to help you do this. And it's a lot of heavy lifting for one person or even one brand. Totally. And then it also wanted to be something that it wasn't just a NEBCO initiative, but an industry initiative, you know, not just us, but as a whole, coming from a couple of different places. So that group of good folks, helped me do some really dope things last year, and we raised 57K total in our first year of doing that. And then we had other breweries jump on board. So both Two Roads and Athletic put up scholarships. So we ended up awarding 4 annual scholarships last year. Put 4 people of color through the Brewing Science Program last year, 2 of which were Black women, which is just
wow,
it's incredible.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Just one more thing on the nitty gritty. Because endowments are how a lot of these universities run in general. Some, especially some of these prestigious ones, have massive endowments. Money's in the market, and they're going to be good for a long time. Does Sacred Heart have an endowment itself? Are you tied in through that? In terms of the actual structure of how you're doing that and gaining that interest and where that money's invested. Is that tied in with Sacred Heart? And did they give you guidance on getting to that place? Because that endowment part is kind of a huge key to be able to do this for a very long time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So they do have their own endowment, and it's tied in specifically with them. So we write a pledge directly to Sacred Heart for this specific purpose. Like, this is where those dollars are going to go, and that it's tied in and looped in with all the other money that is with Sacred Heart in order to get the highest interest rate and the most benefit from it.
That's incredible.
Yeah, they did. They provided Jeff Stopper, who heads up the Brewing Science Program, and also essentially Kieran, who's he handles different endowment accounts and funds and helps those groups fundraise for whatever it is. So he joined our scholarship committee. He's been on board with this since we wrote it and helped us write the language and do it in the right way and pledge and really explain how everything works and what would need to happen and to be realistic about how much money we really have to raise too if this is what we want to do.
Incredible.
And that's one part that I'd like to hear a little bit more about, because, I mean, 56K raised in a year is a wild amount of money. I know there's a beer festival. What other methods have you employed to get to that figure?
So, yeah, a couple. One, asking for donations, right? We had just breweries that reached out. I called in a lot of relationships I've built over the years and people that know me and care, and just being like, hey man, doing this, can you donate? And yeah, a lot of people cut checks and just donated, from Allagash, you know, biggest Allagash, all the way down to smaller local breweries here in town, you know? So, that being a part of it. Also, my fiance, also a beer influencer, Jess Beerme on Instagram, who's crazy into craft beer. She's a Latina that's big into craft beer. Her and another local influencer, Tom M, teamed up and did a bottle raffle where they called in all their relationships from craft breweries. They all sent in a bottle of something dope, and people bought raffle tickets for $1, and we raffled off really, really dope bottles of goodies from all over the country, and that in itself raised $8,000, which was pretty awesome. And that was like during COVID, yeah. So between that, we've done a bunch of people that have just wanted to do their own little fundraisers and donate directly to it. We had one of our distributors donate $1 from every case of Sea Hag they sold in a month directly to the scholarship. We had accounts that wanted to do their own little fundraisers and throw it in, and it all adds up. And our big one for the year is the Change in the Air Festival. Yeah. And that was important on a lot of levels, because when we talk about diversifying the industry, the truth is most of us in the industry are not brewers, right? That's not the majority of who is employed in the craft beer scene. It's tap room, it's packaging, it's marketing, it's sales. And for me, the scholarship on the brewing side is kind of the first step into wanting to diversify. It's the most obvious, and it's the first step. But if we're going to diversify the industry, it needs to be more than just who's brewing in the industry. And more importantly, we have to diversify who's drinking craft beer, right? Mm-hmm. And what that space looks like. You can't ask people to join an industry that they're not participating in from a casual level.
Totally.
So we wanted to do something that was going to diversify and be educational to bring people of color into craft beer. And it was important that we threw a festival that didn't look like your traditional festival, because your traditional beer festival is a pretty predominantly male white space. And then throwing that traditional beer fest and then asking a bunch of black folks to come to this space that they're not comfortable in the sense that you're not playing the kind of music or the kind of food that we eat, and then being like, yeah, be here, we're welcoming. It's one thing to say you're welcoming, but to truly be welcoming, you need to be intentional in that. Mm-hmm. So we threw a festival geared towards people of color, where all black and brown owned food vendors, black and brown musicians that played, local businesses, vendors, that were all, and then all black and brown artists at that space, and through this dope festival for the culture, and then brought beer into that space as an accent into that space, as opposed to the other way around. And it was awesome, man. And what we wanted was not for it. The intention wasn't to be this black exclusive festival. Yeah. It was to be this all inclusive festival, but it needed to be intentionally focused on being welcoming to people of color. So people showed up. It was a lot of stress, and we were nerve wracked because we didn't sell a lot of tickets up until, you know, literally the day or two before. We had like 100 tickets sold or so. And I had 50 vendors we had 22 really dope breweries. We had a bunch of 15 different artists that all had their art displays. Yeah. We had DJs and live music throughout the day. And then we had like another 15 or 20 vendors that were there. And I'm like, shit, only 100 people show up to this thing. It sucks. And that it covered the important thing was to cover our costs and throw a dope festival and execute on a dope festival so that we could build on it going forward. But the day before and day of, man, people showed out. We ended up selling out at over 500 people. It was an amazing, amazing day and a very diverse crowd. You had over half the people of color, and then the other half were like people that go to beer fest all the time that have been to it. And then the thing that I loved the most that I heard from breweries were that they're having these thoughtful, cool conversations again that they haven't had in a beer fest in so long. There wasn't a line. We had a lot of breweries that had a lot of hype, like Fox Farm and Lawson's and breweries that like people know. And as soon as you go to a beer fest, they're the ones with the longest line, and they didn't have lines here because most of the people had never heard of them before. Never tried their beers. So everyone's coming up thoughtful, and they're like, what is this? Where are you from? When someone asked Lawson, so where are you guys out of?
Yeah.
It was like kind of a very cool thing. Yeah. And then the brewers are like being like, they loved it. It was like, yeah, I get to talk about my beer for real.
100%.
Not to like some fanboy, you know? Yeah. Yeah. So it created this really cool environment. And then the people that had been to Beer Fest forever were like, this is the best Beer Fest I've ever been to. Like, cause we're playing hip hop and really awesome music. You got a bunch of black folks doing the electric slide and doing the cha-cha slide. And you got vendors and games, and you've got really dope art all mixed in. And there was this cool aspect of that. You weren't just getting a beer and waiting in line to get another beer. You were getting a beer and you were looking at art and you were checking out this vendor and you were listening to some music, and then you get another beer and then you get a bite to eat. And it was like, you know, we had soul food, we had empanadas, we had barbecue, and we had like things truly instinctively built into the culture. And then all the vendors that we had there, we asked them, we gave them comp tickets. We're like, bring your people. Like, people have to also see this, right, for the first time, and not have to invest the first time into something they've never been a part of. And then from there, man, it was something that blew up in a really cool way. We ended up raising just under $10,000 from that festival. And that put us over the edge. On top of we brewed a Black and Beautiful beer at NEBCO, yeah. And that was also a huge contributor. And we had that debuted at the festival. Bears Barbecue and Black Hog, a local brewery here, brewed a collaboration beer for that day and had it available. And it was just one of those things where it was like the community gave a shit, a bunch of breweries that really cared, and we picked breweries that we have relationship with that we knew. A, that we know, B, that we know kind of cared about the movement that we were doing, and that were really good breweries too, because it wasn't just about, you've got a festival out in Pittsburgh, Barrel and Flow, which kind of gave us the blueprint that something like this is possible. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, these guys are doing it on a really big scale, on a cool scale, authentic event, and we're like, yo, there's nothing like this happening, and this kind of event should be the standard for how events go. It shouldn't be like only happening specifically in one or two places. It needs to be normalized. Totally. So that it becomes something that, you know, brings a lot of people in general. So it was cool to be able to like, all right, these guys have done it. It's possible, it's doable, and people will show up. And we don't have a lot of black owned breweries here, and getting distribution into Connecticut is a complicated process. You know, you have wholesaler agreements and so forth. So it was hard to like just ask brands to just be here, but we got a lot of awesome breweries and introducing people to really good beer and building the rest of the environment around the culture in general. And it was awesome. So we're just launched it. It's going to be happening again this year, Juneteenth weekend. But now we've got more buy-in. We're going to be able to up the capacity another 300 people. We're going to be able to add some more breweries and some more vendors and extend the party, add a lot more live music. We ended it at 5 last year and no one wanted to go home. Everybody wanted to stay and hang, you know. It was cool. It was one of the probably one of the most proud moments of my career. And in all honesty, the first beer fest that I ever felt that comfortable in as an individual, you know. And I've been in craft beer a long time, and yeah, I feel comfortable in my own skin, but I've never felt that at home at a beer festival before. It was dope.
That's amazing. It's
fucking,
man,
amazing.
And I think just that, yeah, it was just a simple thing you'd said, but just about using beer to accent a cultural festival, really, or just, you know, I think that is a small way to kind of reshape the paradigm of how you look at it. But put that way, it's like, it makes so much sense. And it's just really encouraging to hear about that. That the end result was, it's just very, very cool is really all I have to say about it.
I'll tell you one thing. I told you before I get excited, but I'm going to say it right here. So to hold it to it, I'm fucking, Connecticut's not that far away. I'm fucking coming this year. I'm
going to
take it.
Yeah,
I'm coming.
Come
I'm
on down.
Dead ass serious. That's fucking amazing, dude.
Thanks, man.
If we're good to, we got to get back over next door, get to start working, but we can't let you off the hook that easy.
Yes, we end this silly little thing a little light after usually, covering maybe some heavier topics. So we call the three base sink. So Matt can walk you through it and I'll fill in the rest.
I'm going to hit you with the three bay. Thought about a couple different things. I love the Robinson connection. I was going to give you some famous Robinsons, but Noah is a big soccer fan. And I think the soccer in college, very cool. We're going to pair you up. You're going to pick three NEBCO beers. Noah's going to give you three soccer positions, and you're going to have to go free association and tell us why that beer would relate to that soccer position. We're going to get a little creative here to end the day.
Well, I'll leave it free. I mean, you know the beer portfolio better than anyone. And, you know, there's only 11 positions on a soccer field. So I'll let you kind of figure out the NEBCO soccer team.
The NEBCO
three-member NEBCO soccer team.
Three-member NEBCO soccer team. All right. Let's go. Seahag has got to be your forward.
Yeah, you got to be striking half the time,
right? Right? Always goals. Superdot's our number two, so that's your midfielder all day. Mm-hmm. You know, he's Superdot's the one that supports, right? The assists all day. And then Facehugger's got to play defense. He's the new guy on the block, but he holds it down. Right? Yeah. Keeps us level headed in the back and lets us know other things are possible. Keeps those other goals from being scored.
Oh, I love it! Yeah. I love it, man.
Well done, easy breezy.
Yeah, just because, everyone's at work right now, but we'll definitely be following up on email just about some more details about we have an internship program, pretty new. It isn't explicitly women focused, but it manifested that way sort of as a response from, everything last summer. Basically, how that goes as of right now is it's a paid internship for either kind of based on how the person wants to structure it for 160 hours. And then we brew a beer that basically funds the program. So starting small, but just when you're talking about endowments of 250 mil, it's, or 250,000, it's like, holy shit, I guess this iceberg has not even begun to be scratched. So yeah, you'll definitely be hearing from me about that. And I'd also love to talk about ways we could contribute to that endowment in Amazing. The following years. So,
yeah, man, I really appreciate that. That's awesome.
Well, thank you so much for doing this, man. Truly, one of the most inspiring conversations I've had as just an individual with that much, a creator of that much momentum. Is just inherently inspiring to be around. So, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, man. Thank you. Appreciate you guys reaching out and wanting to have these kind of conversations and helping to promote these kind of things help promote the scholarship as a whole and the movement as a whole. And it's important, man. I appreciate you guys.
It's amazing. The talk is the easy part. The work and the doing is always the hard part. And what, like I said, watching you do in such an effective way is really fucking inspiring, for real. One last question, though. Now, after spending, I didn't want to say it at the beginning, but after spending like an hour and a half together, maybe if I come see you in June, can I call you Jammy? Will we be on Jammy
all
terms?
All day, man. All day. All day. Yeah, man. We're on Jammy terms now.
We're on
now,
Jammy
baby.
Terms, baby. That's good. No bullshit. Connecticut's not far. I've got a couple places I've been trying to touch and that COVID made hard to do so. I'll reach out beforehand, but I'm going to make my way down there in June.
Yeah, man. We'd love to have you. That'd be dope. And if you're going to send some beer now, put some Lux in there.
Oh, don't worry. I remembered. I have a good memory. I'm just a terrible procrastinator. So it kind of works against itself. Yeah.
I'll hit you with a follow-up email and I'll grab info from you and anything to send a care package your way.
We'll do, man. Appreciate you.
Good luck on the meeting at 3.
Thanks.
I'll see you later.
I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden, it will all become lovely. The flower that opens.